You want to start within?
Sure. Are we recording?
Do I have to ask that every time?
Sure. Yeah.
Every time.
All right. You lead it off.
Hello, and welcome to Grapes and Grain Podcast. I'm Teenie.
And I'm Laura. And this podcast is about our favorite thing in the world,
alcoholic beverages. So today we're going to explore spirits, but not just any and every spirits, specifically brandy and whiskey.
So you might be wondering how this relates to beer and wine. Well, it turns out those two beverages are birthed, if you will, from these two other drinks. Whiskey and brandy are distilled beer and wine, pretty much. So to help us explore that and unpack that concept in comparison, we have Robert Licorice in studio with us today, co-founder of Iron Root Republic Distillery and one of the probably best distillers there, right?
That'd be my brother. He'd probably argue that one, but I'm pretty good too.
Nice.
Well, thanks for joining us all the way from Denison, Texas. Robert, we have a little segment that we called, and we would love to kick you off. So tell us, what you drinking?
What you drinking?
I'm double fisting right now, actually. I've got a little bit of our whiskey. I actually have our cast strength bourbon in my left hand right now. It's called Harbinger. We release it every fall. It's was the very first whiskey we released, hence the name Harbinger, and I guess we kind of went with a Greek theme from there on, so most everything's Greek or Roman mythology with all the names that we go forward with. But it's a big guy. It's 118 proof, made with locally grown grains. Oh, yeah, and it's, for cast strength, it's actually kind of low. They get up to like 140. I mean, you can get some really crazy whiskeys.
So when you say 118 proof, what percentage of alcohol is that?
I'm just going to divide by two. So 118 is about 59%.
Okay. Wow. Excellent. Yeah, that sounds pretty strong, in my opinion. Yeah.
It'll do the job, that's for sure.
Did you distill that one specifically to have neat, or is it meant more to like be on the rocks to kind of like mellow it out a bit?
This one's blended to be a sweeter, fruitier blend, so it's going to hide the alcohol and mass alcohol a little bit more. So it's a little bit more of a neat or maybe one big rock type of whiskey.
Awesome.
Laura, what you drinking?
What you drink?
Well, for you today, I'm so excited. So you guys know y'all took the beer route. But for you today, I have the Toast of Paris, the Cognac of Napoleon, Courvoisier.
Ooh, Courvoisier, like in all the rap songs?
Yes, exactly.
Classy.
So I was drawn to this bottle specifically because it's gorgeous and I'm a sucker for good packaging.
Tell us what it looks like.
It is purple and gold and it's embossed with like the shape of the Eiffel Tower. And has their logo embossed in gold all around it, too. So it's beautiful.
Very royal looking.
It is quite royal. All fancy, you know, how wine do. So this one specifically is VSOP, which I want to share this because I laughed out loud when I looked at the difference between VS, which is a 3-star, like around 2-year aged cognac. It's very special, VS. Very special.
Oh, that's what that stands for?
Yeah, and VSOP was very special old pale. And that just tickled me quite a bit. I thought it was going to be something really fancy.
I feel like that could be like the slogan for our podcast once we make it big.
Very special.
Very special old podcast.
I love it. So yeah, I'm pretty pumped to try it. I've only had brandy a couple times before, so I was really excited to delve into this episode. The first time I had it, my boyfriend and I looked at each other and said, oh my God, I think we're brandy people. It was delicious. But Teeny, can you please tell me, what is that delicious cup in your hand that you're drinking?
What you drinking?
Well, this is another Iron Republic whiskey. It's called Prometheus, is that right?
Promethean.
Promethean. Ooh, and I know exactly nothing about it, so I'm going to turn it back over to Robert.
Prometheans are 103 proof bourbon. It's a little bit on the spicier style of the blend. We've got a little bit of rye in the mash bill, but it focuses on actually a flint corn, which is not a dent corn. Dent corn is typically what's being used. And the flint, actually off the still, when we distill it by itself, it actually has almost like a cayenne pepper type note to it. It's a little bit spicier. So we do that with a little bit of yellow corn and some of the purple corn to balance it out. But it's a little bit spicier, more cocktail friendly. It stands up a lot better in cocktails than some of the others.
Awesome.
And you love whiskey cocktails. You always are.
I love whiskey cocktails. I'm also a big fan of rye. So yeah. I'm glad that you picked this one out for me.
Wow, that's
really
good.
Tasty.
Yeah, it is.
Well, now we're going to get into the nitty gritty. But first, Laura, fermentation and distillation, we're going to talk a lot about these two terms today. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, what is the difference?
Yeah, totally. So at a base level, Fermentation is the process that happens when yeast converts sugar into alcohol. And that's what makes alcohol. Sometimes it produces extra gases like CO2, which can cause carbonation, or in like kombucha, it'll create some great gut bacteria, things like that.
The way I explain it is like the sugar eats, or the yeast eats the sugar and it farts out alcohol.
Yeah, pretty much.
Which that's like fermentation.
The really fun elementary school, yeah, definition of it. In distillation. So distillation is the process of heating a liquid that and separating it based on different boiling points. So when you're talking about distillation of spirits, you're heating a either wine or a beer type liquid. And alcohol boils at a different temperature than water, which is 172 Fahrenheit for alcohol, roughly, and 212 for water. And you use special equipment and machinery to separate those different components and treat it from there. So depending on what style of spirit you're making.
Awesome. No, Robert, we know that you're a pro at making whiskey. Tell us a little bit about what you do. How long have you been doing it? And a little bit about Iron Root and what you guys produce.
So I've been distilling since about 2011. Basically, I graduated from law school, decided I didn't want to be a lawyer, and immediately went and started working at distilleries. So
I can really relate to that.
The first couple of years was really just kind of going around the country and trying to learn from the people who did it best. We have one of the biggest teachers I had in my life was Hubert Germain Rabon and his apprentice, Nancy Fraley. And then she's a kind of famous blender in the spirits world. But he is actually a master cognac distiller that left France and came over to the United States and really got into California and started distilling New World grapes rather than the traditional and very specific grapes you have to do for cognac. From there, I went and actually did a little mini internship down at Belcone's at 2011. Some of our friends down south in Waco, Texas, that do some pretty fantastic whiskeys down there. But what's really interesting is that they both use European style distillation and blending and aging, which is basically what we've taken on at Iron Root. We're very much based and versed in French style distillation and aging techniques. So that's kind of how we ended up in Denison. You know that Denison's sister cities with cognac because of a really long and beautiful history. And so we thought, what better place to, one, start the Texas grape brandy tradition and also create some really fantastic whiskeys as well. So we make, primarily we do brandy and whiskeys. We also do a little bit of gin and some other stuff as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, we actually, released our very first experimental brandy 2015. It was an orange muscat that we actually had distilled and aged in some rumble barrels from Balcones, which you guys are familiar with. That's really cool.
Yeah.
It turned into a really crazy, really awesome, fun, really small release. And I think Whiskey Cake here in Dallas actually bought the entire lot.
Oh, and had it there. I bet they do. They have an interesting selection for sure.
Oh, yeah. And then so our main line, we do actually some local Chenin Blanc grapes that we get a load every year and distill. And so it's still aging. The oldest barrels right now are just getting about 3 years old. So we're getting up there. And brandy's a little bit more delicate of a spirit, so we have to be more careful when we're dealing with that on the aging side. The whiskeys, we started releasing whiskey last year. We've done a couple releases of our main whiskeys, and it's been kind of a wild ride. We focus on heirloom corns and different other heirloom grains, and won a bunch of awards already, which is really kind of humbling and really fun. And we actually make a whiskey that's only sold in Europe, which is actually kind of crazy.
I haven't been touting that. I've been telling everyone about that. Can you just give us a quick rundown about what that is?
Yeah, like how do you get a spirit sold in Europe, first of all, and then like why is it being made available there?
Well, again, it's one of those amazing things about being where we are. Texas has this crazy, amazing history.
Whoop, whoop.
Yeah.
In 1836, we won our independence decided that we needed some allies. So we established an embassy in London, and the ambassador decided they needed more offices and they wanted one that was actually really close to where the Buckingham Palace is so they'd have connection to the royals. So they went to Barry Brothers and Rudd in London, which is a famous wine and spirits merchant. They've been in business since 1698, which is kind of really hard to even imagine. Wow. They've been in the same building the entire time.
And whoa.
I mean, they have their own entire history relating to Napoleon III and a whole bunch of different stuff. But to honor that, they decided, actually about 5 years ago, they wanted to release a Texas whiskey. So for the last 5 years, they'd really been searching for a Texas distillery to really kind of grab their attention. Every year they would send out an email to all the Texas distillers. They'd all send samples over. And last year we sent samples over. It was before we had released any whiskey here in Texas or in the United States. And we're like, hey, you know, why not? And they tasted through some of the barrel samples we sent, fell in love with what we're doing, and now their master blender does a blend of our whiskeys that they release over there once a year.
So. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Have you been over there to visit?
I have. We got to go over for the launch, and then I actually was just over there in February, and I'll probably be back again next February. So it's a little bias on my part, because I'm like, hey, we need to send them more whiskey. I think I need to go back over there. So
sounds like we need to go record an episode at this Texas embassy over in London.
We truly should. That's so awesome.
Okay, great.
We talked about the process between making beer into whiskey and wine into brandy. So the product that you distill the beer and the wine into it, how does that compare to what people might find retail, what they're consuming?
I mean, it's really different. And again, every type of whiskey has its own kind of mash bills that are going to really vary from beer. I mean, beer is mostly made up of malted barley, hops, water, yeast. Now you get some of the wheated beers will have some wheat in the mash bill, but generally it's going to be primarily malted barley. So if you're making a single malt, you're going to be really close to that. You're going to do 100% malted barley. Just don't do the hops side of it. It's basically just cook the barley, get the yeast in there, and let it go.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay, cool.
If you're doing bourbon or like a bourbon's going to have a lot of corn in it, which again, not typically an adjunct you see a lot in beer. And there's a few Mexican lagers, I think, that use corn. But so you see a lot of the American style or American spirits or spirits that really came from America. You're going to have either corn or you'll see some rye as well. And so basically, you do the same process that you would do with brewing a beer. You're going to cook the grains at the temperature so you don't damage the enzymes. In the case of barley, wheat, or rye. In the case of corn, you're just going to boil the heck out of it. You're going to bring it all the way up to 212 and just break down those sugars the best you can. So it's a little bit different brewing process. With the real difference on beer that you're going to drink versus distiller's beer is going to be in the fermentation side. With the American style spirits, you really want a little bit warmer, even with some of the scotches, you want a little bit warmer fermentation than you're typically going to have with beer. Because beer, you don't want to have any organic acids form, because you kind of get some of the funky stuff that we find in the tails, some of the different oils and different stuff that's going to appear that are created at higher fermentation temperatures. And
gotcha.
And aging, we need those for barrel aging in the whiskeys. It's what turns into some of the really cool flavors. But when they come off the still, they taste really funky. And if you're going to drink it as a beer, they taste really funky.
Funk has its time and place, but it sounds like not exactly there.
Yeah, exactly.
On the dance floor.
Okay, so what about on the brandy side? Like, how close is what you might pick up at the store in a bottle of wine compared to
a box of Francia?
Or a box. A bottle or a box, forgive me.
Depending how you're feeling.
Yeah. How does that compare to what you guys do before you distill it?
It depends on, again, there's a lot of different traditions that go into this. But typically the French style, you're going to want, and they typically are going to use grapes that are really high in acid. And generally they're harvested much earlier than what you're going to do for, if you're making a wine for a table wine or making some really of the high-end Bordeaux and stuff like that. So because you don't want all the sugars to really form. So for us here in Texas, we're harvesting even earlier, which generally means it's July, end of July.
Sounds like fun.
Yeah, nighttime harvest is what we have to do in order to maintain a little bit higher acidity, because that's really what gives the brandy structure at the end of the day. And I'd say that's two of the really big differences that you're looking for.
Very cool. Now, is brandy a high-end thing? You know, you hear Courvoisier in rap songs. it has this sort of, and even the packaging, very royal, very esteemed. Is it a high-end spirit, or does it go along with the highfalutin nature of, like, wine snobbery and things like that? Or is it really, like, accessible to the common drinker?
That's a depends. So there are definitely brandies out there that you can get for, you know, $9.99, $15.99. Typically, they're going to be brandies that there are not a lot of cognacs that you're going to see now in that price point, but there is a little bit. But generally, they're going to be high in what you call dosage, which is basically flavor additives. So the one kind of the dark things they don't talk a lot about in the French brandy tradition is they do actually will alter flavor by adding a barrel aged syrup or coloring or sweeteners and stuff like that. And so generally the lower end brandies are going to have a lot more of that, where the higher end brandies, there's going to be less of that. They might use a little bit, even on, you know, a 60-year-old cognac, they might use a little bit just to, again, if it became too, a little too dry in the barrel or something like that. But they're the French, especially on the high-end products, what they're going to be using is stuff that they've actually took that syrup or that caramel, mixed it with brandy, and they've been aging it for 100 years, 200 mm-hmm. years. And they're using that to blend in. With the lower-end stuff, it's just syrup. that's why brandy tends to, especially on the lower ends, tend to be a lot sweeter. In and of itself, it's not naturally a really sweet product by itself.
Interesting. I like this one, by the way.
Yeah, it's so, like, caramelly and nutty. I wonder if it's legit aging.
It's definitely making my throat feel better.
Good.
Screw cough syrup. I just need a bottle of brandy.
Yes, yeah. Seriously.
It'll take care of it.
So when we're talking about brandy, we're talking about distilled grapes, basically. So what's the difference in between brandy and like grappa?
So grappa is going to be distilled from basically kind of the leftover part of the winemaking process. Again, everything that you've pressed, generally what they'll do is, and again, it depends on the producer, but they'll may just take that and, again, allow it to continue to ferment, or they might add a little bit of water to it, and some of the lower ones that might actually add a little bit of sugar and stuff to help re-engage fermentation. And it's just, again, make sure they're using every little bit. And you see it really popular in Italy, especially Northern Italy. Actually, I was just there this last year meeting with a couple different grappa producers. And again, like with anything, grappa can be really low-end and really high-end ones. They can be barrel-aged or not barrel-aged. Generally, they're going to be a little bit higher proof, though. I think coming in 120, 100 proof plus a lot of the grappas. But there can be some really great and really flavorful stuff coming out of grappa as well.
Excellent. That high proof has been my grappa experience as well.
Questionable grappa decisions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we see a lot of, and I actually didn't know you guys made brandy, so this is just a great serendipitous thing.
The stars aligned. The stars of Texas.
Yeah.
The single one, lone.
The lone star of Texas has aligned in our favor. There are a lot of whiskey distilleries in North Texas, mm-hmm. but why don't you see a lot of the distilleries here making things like brandy?
Well, part of the reason is a lot of the North Texas distilleries don't actually make most of their products to begin with.
Oh, okay. This is that dirty little secret you and I were talking about. Okay, let's dissect that first.
Again, to actually be a grain to glass or grape to glass, from scratch distillery is kind of a fool's errand on a lot of ends, because it's taking product and, you know, laying it down for 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years. And knowing that you're not going to start even making revenue for several years, let alone start making profit. So most distilleries, what they're going to do is they'll come in and they'll buy whiskey out of Indiana or Kentucky, sometimes even out of Tennessee as well, or even Alberta, Canada. They get some rye whiskeys up in there as well. They'll bring them here. They might let some sit in their warehouse for a little bit, but then they'll do their blend and they'll bottle the product here. And then they'll label it as Texas bourbon just because it's bottled here. Now there's a lot of arguments in our industry about what can you call, put a state name in front of. You're supposed to put state of distillation on a bottle, but there's a lot of people who don't do that. So generally the best way to see if a whiskey is actually made here in Texas is to turn the bottle. And if it says distilled in Texas, then it's something that's here made here. If it says produced or bottled or crafted or one of those ambiguous terms, then it's more than likely was not made here in Texas.
So what were you guys doing prior to releasing your whiskeys then? Since it sounds like you open a distillery, you can't just turn out whiskey right away if you're doing the grain to glass thing.
So that's where our gin came in, and doing a little bit of vodka. And we even had some moonshine that we put out there in the market just kind of for fun, some white corn whiskey. But it's for us, that was more of an education type thing that we could show people. This is what the whiskey's like off the still. When we're tasting it off the still, this is what we're tasting, and this is what it's like a year later, 2 years later. And you can really kind of show an evolution of a barrel, which is really educating for people. So mm-hmm. that's kind of why we ended up doing that. But those were the products that we started out with just to generate a little bit of revenue and actually to start developing relationships with people in the industry, to go meet store owners, to meet people on the street. And it's been a lot of fun.
Awesome. So back to the original question. So why don't a lot of distilleries do brandy?
Oh, so a lot of them, because grapes, especially here in Texas, they're really expensive. Most of the wine producers are buying up all the grapes that are being produced here in Texas. The High Plains is really starting to kick out, and they're planting a ton of grapes. There's actually a really large vineyard up in Denison. They're working on turning it in, actually having a winery up there. But right now, it's just been 40 acres of grapes. They've been planted since the 70s, I think, the oldest grapes. So there's actually, you're starting to see old growth vines here in Texas, which is really exciting. But most of that's bought up by the wineries, so it kind of jumps the price up a little bit. And so the cost for me to produce one barrel of brandy is the same to produce 8 barrels of whiskey.
Oh, my goodness.
So
there's a big difference. And then to do, especially when you're doing things, in my mind, is the proper methodology. Again, using the right barrels and spending the right time. French oak's very expensive. So, I mean, everywhere down the line, it's just that much more of an expensive product to make. Mm. And then the market for brandy right now is not a huge market. Now, you're starting to see a lot of the bourbon drinkers are starting to find Armagnacs and Cognac. And you're seeing it's actually growing. It's actually really starting to grow, which is really exciting to me because, again, I've been a brandy person for a really long time. And so you're starting to see that market. So I wouldn't be surprised that you'll see a couple other distilleries start working on grape brandies. I know another one, the Waco distillery, and the new Waco distillery that should be opening sometime and God knows when. But it's also, I know they've talked with them. They're going to be doing some brandy as well. And so you're going to see, starting to see a few producers, especially down, I imagine Fredericksburg, a couple of those distilleries down there are going to start producing brandy as well. So I wouldn't be surprised if you start seeing some peach brandies and some other stuff as well pop up. I know we're working on blueberry brandy right now. It's going to be, we're going to do some eau de vie and some really fun stuff.
Ooh, eau de vie. So. What does that mean? That sounds French.
Yeah, that sounds fancy. The brandy.
Eau de vie. Yeah. Nailed it.
Yeah.
And it's a French term, and it covers a variety of different things, but generally you see it and referred to in a younger spirit or one that isn't barrel aged, just put in like a demijohn, allowed to air oxidize age. So, and again, the term can be used a little bit wider than how I typically use it, but that's typically how you see it used.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, we're going to take a commercial break. We'll be right back
with Robert Licorice.
Yeah.
Hey, Laura, what are you getting into this weekend? Any fun plans?
Well, I'm going to head out to Iron Root Republic Distillery.
That's cool. What's happening out there?
Well, you know they do distillery tours every Saturday at 1, but since this Saturday is the first of the month, they're going to be open from 2 to 8:30 p.m., making cocktails all day. So, you know, I'm going to spend the whole day out there.
Oh, that's cool. Do they do that the first Saturday of every month?
Hell yeah, they do.
Sweet. Well, I know they're known for their whiskey. Is that what you'll be drinking?
Oh, man, they do so much more. They're going to have an epic Bloody Mary bar featuring their vodka, and they'll be making handcrafted cocktails with their delicious gin. Plus, they have live entertainment. And did you know the two brothers who own and operate it are out there shaking cocktails in person?
Shake it till you make it. Where are they located?
It's right around the corner in Denison, Texas. But if y'all can't wait till Saturday, you can find a bottle of Iron Root Republic whiskey at a Specs near you.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast.
If you are a retailer or a producer and would like to sponsor us or have your product featured in our What You Drinkin' segment, drop us an email at grapesingrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain, at gmail.com.
Cheers!
Get it too.
There you go.
So we're back.
We're back.
We're back.
We could be sponsored by Iron Root Republic this time.
Oh, yeah.
That's right. I brought cornbread and whiskey, so here we go.
Oh, my God. That's so true.
That's payment enough.
Yeah. Cornbread, corn whiskey. Yeah, tell us a little bit about the corn, because what you guys is doing is unique, not only because you guys are grain to glass in the most traditional sense, or in most authentic sense, let's put it that way, but you guys also grow your own grains that you use. Is that correct?
Well, we don't farm them personally. Again, we work 95% of the grain we use comes within 60 miles of the distillery. So,
excellent. That's so cool.
So, yeah, we get to work with a lot of farmers, especially ones that are, again, we talk about we use a lot of non-GMO grains. And that's, for us, that's a lot about flavor. We've distilled GMO, yellow corn, the traditional number two, and we've also done a non-GMO version of that. And I could tell you, without a doubt, the GMO one is way sweeter than the non-GMO.
Hmm.
And it's, and corn whiskey in of itself is a very sweet grain. So we decided to go to a different direction and try to use some of the corns that actually have some different flavors to them. They have a little bit more earthiness or fruity, different characteristics to them other than just the sweet, traditional yellow corn. But that's because that's how sweet corn has been, you know, grown for years. And that's the way we've bred it to be, is very sweet, carbohydrate heavy.
And then everything's super concentrated, I guess, once you get it distilled.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
So why blue corn?
We actually, that's the one color we don't actually use. So that's,
oh, I'm sorry. I thought I read that on the website.
No, we actually leave that to our friends down in Waco. They actually, they have made blue corn famous, which is really, really exciting because they were one of the first ones to really kind of get into that. What have we not been doing the US? Because they basically are distilling world up until, again, the late 80s, 90s, was down to, you know, just a handful of distilleries who were making the same product using the same grains that were grown there that, again, they could easily get for cheap. Balcones was the first one that really came back and said, well, why don't we use some of these other corns? And so we've kind of taken that on to a whole different level where they just focus on blue corn. We do basically everything else. So we've distilled almost 20 different species of corn, from dent corns to flint corns, every color of the rainbow except for blue. black, green, orange,
that's so cool.
And just like where grapes have different flavor for different species of grapes, mm-hmm. corn's the exact same way. Now, it's a little bit more nuanced, I would say, than grapes, but it's still very much there. Off the still, you can really tell a difference between the different corns. Which is really exciting and really fun for us.
Yeah, that is exciting and fun because, you know, I'm a big whiskey drinker, obviously. And once I realized that whiskey was just kind of like distilled beer and conceptually they came from the same place, I was like, well, that makes sense. But I really like the flavor of whiskey, where I feel like a lot of people who drink cocktails, they try to add other flavors to get the taste of the spirit out of there. I'm like, nope, old fashioned is my go-to cocktail.
Yeah.
Don't taint my whiskey. So why don't you tell us a little bit about the flavor profiles of the whiskeys that you brought here today and how they differ?
So I've got five different whiskeys here with me today. I've got, I guess the newest one that's just about to come out is Esoteric, which is our American whiskey. It's a blend of different corn whiskeys and bourbon. It's 97 proof. It's kind of a culmination of a lot of our experimental batches of trying out some of these different colored corns or different types of corn, and kind of blending that together. And so it's a little bit sweeter profile because, again, it is more corn focused. Mm-hmm. But it's also the lowest proof of what we've done to date at 97 proof. We tend to do very high proof things. So it's kind of a fun, basically every year that we release Esoteric, it'll be different because it'll be different experiments. Because next year we'll probably include a number of different rye varietals actually in the blend that we've done this year. I also have Promethean, which is probably the whiskey that's been most widely out there. It's 103 proof bourbon. It's kind of our standard that we go to that we have around all year round. Again, as we said earlier, it's a little bit of rye and some of the different colored corns.
Mm-hmm. It's treating me nicely over here.
Oh, yeah. from there, we'll jump to Harbinger, which is our cask strength bourbon, which is a little sweeter. It's got a little bit of wheat in it, a little bit of barley. And it's got a lot of purple corn in it, which is one of our favorite corns
purple
to distill.
Purple corn.
Yeah.
And the purple corn, it actually originated in South America up in the Andes Mountains. So the Incas actually were using the purple corn to make a lot of their food, which is kind of fun.
That is. Can I ask a question before you go? Oh, what does cask strength mean?
So when we put whiskey in a barrel, so off the still for us, the whiskey off of our pot still, it's going to come off about 140 proof. Legally in the U.S., you could not put whiskey in a barrel above 125 proof. So we actually have to water it down. Traditionally, you actually bourbon went in the barrel even much lower than that. And so there's no rule on really how low you can go, except you don't want to go below 80 because then it's not whiskey anymore. But by changing the proof of what you're putting, what we call the entry proof for the barrel, you can actually influence what type of flavors and things you're going to extract out of the wood, because different flavors and tannins and stuff, some are alcohol soluble, other ones are water soluble. So by changing the proof, you can actually affect what you're extracting out more quickly. So especially for whiskeys that are going to be under 8 years old, by changing that proof, you can really affect how that spirit's going to turn out at the end of the day.
Very interesting.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
And obviously, you guys make bourbon, so you use new oak for some of your barrels.
Yes.
But is that exclusively what you use?
No. So that's how the other thing that we use. We actually practice, again, a French brandy technique called élevage, which literally means to raise the barrels.
Yeah. Élevage.
Yeah. Nailed it.
No, you got to say it now, too.
Élevage. She gives me a really hard time. I'm hiring a French tutor because my pronunciation of French is horrendous. It is so bad.
So is mine, but in discovering where alcohol comes from, we have to learn a lot of foreign language.
Yeah, so. And it is, I struggle. It's on the struggle bus.
Especially on the wine front, I would imagine, between all the German and French and Italian.
Yeah, I mean, I got the Italian. I can confidently rock the glottal stop in German, but man, the French. I guess I'll get there, though. I will.
We can choose the barrel entry proof based on the mash bill, because, again, kind of what we think will best complement it will actually alter that entry proof. And then once the spirit's in the barrel, then based on your relative humidity and your temperatures, that proof can go either up or down the barrel through the angel share. It can either lose a lot of water or lose a lot of alcohol, one of the two. Here in Texas, it's quite warm. Again, we like to joke that, you know, we have like 2-3 weeks of winter, where in Scotland they have 2 or 3 weeks of summer. So for us, because of the heat and we have all these barometric pressure shifts due to all the storms that run through our area. I mean, you probably hear the thunder in the background right now. It really caused that whiskey to go in and out of that barrel very quickly and very rapidly. Mm-hmm. So we have a much higher angel share here in Texas. And being closer to the lake, we actually have a little bit higher humidity, so we don't quite skyrocket in proof as much as you would in other parts of Texas. But the proof does go up generally in our barrels. On the lowest level, we can actually see it go down a little bit. Mm-hmm. But generally, it's going to go up a little bit. So I might put it in at 115 or to 118, and it might actually move up from there. So again, you will see, I think the highest proof we've pulled anything out of a barrel so far is 127 proof, mm-hmm. Which is quite spicy.
Yeah.
So, so is like it that true that you can make whiskey quicker here in Texas because of that temperature?
That's always a very tough discussion, because a lot of people say, well, whiskey ages faster in smaller barrels, or it ages faster in warmer climates. And my response to that is, age is a function of time. Time moves at one speed. What's different is that we actually extract much faster here in Texas. So you're going to have a much higher extraction rate out of the barrel. So the whiskey coming out of Texas is going to get much darker very quick. We can get to where it's a really golden amber in 3-4 months. So it can get really dark very quick. Now, that being said, that's only part of the aging process. The other part is oxidation, which is going to take place, and esterification, which take place over time. And that's really why you see a lot of the older whiskeys, people tend to like those flavors better, or they have very specific flavor notes. Oxidative notes in whiskey are very apparent. So I can really tell a difference of the whiskeys on age just based on how much oxidative notes there are. Now, may not be what you like. You may really like some of the grain forward notes, some of the fruitiness, some of the different things that are intermediaries in that esterification process, or they might just be from the grain themselves. So it really is dependent. So aging doesn't happen faster. Extraction happens faster here.
Interesting.
Yeah,
good to know.
That is really interesting. So in regards to wine, when we talk about like pricing and quality of wine, so a lot of times a higher price is regard to specifically the tightness of the wood grain that's associated with the oak that they're using, mm-hmm. because of that evaporation, that oxidation that occurs. Do you see the same relation in the quality and the cost of brandies and whiskeys as far as the quality and caliber of wood you're finding, or is it just?
That's always tough. So in the craft world, I guess in the quote unquote craft, I prefer to call it smaller distillery world. What you're going to see, pricing is going to be based on one, just economies of scale, producing, how much you're producing versus your overhead. Mm-hmm. So some distillers are more efficient at that than others. So you might see some 6-month-old whiskey in poor wood that they're charging $70 for. So it's not necessarily, that may not necessarily be the case. Or you may have a whiskey that's aged 4 or 5 years, done in really great, high quality wood. And again, longer yard aging and some of those other things that really indicate better quality barrels. And you might be, $40 or $50 a bottle. So it just depends. Generally, the smaller producers are going to charge more just on a normal basis. For us, all of our barrels that we use are going to be what I would consider higher quality. They're going to be at least 18 months yard aged for the American oak. The Euro oak that we use is generally going to be 2 years to 3 years. And the French oak that we use is all 4 years plus on the yard aging. And then as far as you have different levels of toast or different combinations of toast and char, mm-hmm. you can do that can change pricing on barrels.
Mm. And the flavor profile,
Right? Yeah, especially. Yeah. And that's been something that's just really come into whiskey production in the last 3 or 4 years. Basically, we've stolen that from wine.
I was going to ask, you do something kind of special with the way you toast and char your barrels. Is that correct?
Right. Typically and traditionally in Kentucky, they use a char 3 or even sometimes a char 4, but typically it's a char 3. A lot of these smaller producers start out doing char 4 because they thought it would give them more color and they'd filter the whiskey a little bit faster because there's a bigger layer of char. Whiskey going in and out, it's going to filter a little bit more. But what we've discovered here in Texas is that if we use that higher char, that char 3, char 4, the whiskey goes through that layer a lot, but that's actually stripping out a lot of the flavor. Mm-hmm. Now, carbon filtering is removing flavor out of the whiskey. So we actually use char 1, sometimes char 2, but typically char 1, and then we'll do different toast profiles on the barrel, again, what we stole from the wine industry. again, you can actually, based on how long you toast and different lengths and waves, you can actually get more vanillas, more caramels, or other flavors you can actually coax out of wood. And so we use that and do a light layer of char on top of it. So we have so much interaction with the wood that we still get that same level of filtration, but we're allowed to preserve a lot more flavor out of the barrel itself.
Excellent. I had a question. Let's talk about proper glassware first. How should you be drinking whiskey? Does it matter which varietal? How should you be drinking brandy? Are these the right glasses? I got these. They look like little
Cupidas.
Ooh, is that what they're called?
Yeah. The nosing glass. In the Scotch distillers, they tend to use this shape glassware quite a bit when they're in the blending room. Mm. They like to keep their hands away from the bulb so they're not heating up the whiskey, because when you heat it up, the aromatics will jump out a little bit more at you. Mm-hmm. And the way it's shaped, obviously, it's going to funnel those aromatics a little bit closer together. As far as proper glassware, that to me, that's always a misnomer with spirits. Again, our big thing is that you drink how you like and how you want to like. If you're drinking to analyze a whiskey, that's a very different thing than drinking for enjoyment, in my opinion. Mm. So one of the things that we use actually at the distillery is a glassware that was developed by the Scotch whiskey with a company called Glencairn. So it's called the Glencairn whiskey drill glass. You'll see it a lot at the kind of play higher end whiskey bars or stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's now they don't have the stem. They do make them with stems, but typically they're just going to have a little kind of bulb that you hold at the bottom. This little mini one I'm holding here.
Yeah, describe it for our listeners who can't see the glass.
So it's going to be kind of tulip-shaped is going to be the description that they use most often with it.
It's so cute. We've got so much mini glassware in our setup right now.
So it's got the bottom part of it's going to be a little bit wider, and then it's going to get closer together as it gets to the top, because it's going to funnel those aromatics. So it basically allows kind of the alcohol to blow off a little bit, and you get a lot more of the flavor aromatics out of the whiskey. So to me, anytime we're doing blending or we're really analyzing whiskey, that's the glassware that we use.
So how do you take your whiskey most often?
I drink it straight most of the time.
Me too. Neat.
It's and again, sometimes it's really fun to really to take some water and add it to the whiskey a few drops at a time to really explore the changes in and proof. What they'll do a lot of times is you can release some aromatics. Some whiskeys will fall apart when you add water to them. But so I always taste it as it's presented to start out with. And then if I'm really doing analysis, that's when I'll actually add a little bit of water. If I'm drinking for enjoyment, because again, generally we're tasting off the still at 140 proof, nothing that they're going to put in a bottle generally is going to phase me too much. So I generally go straight for what they're giving me.
That's
so
funny.
Sounds like I'm the only person here who adds a little bit of sugar and Angostura bitters, little of essence of orange.
Wrong with that. I love a good old fashioned. Yeah. So.
I actually just, so I'm a big old fashioned drinker, but yesterday was the first time I actually took a stab at making old fashioned cocktails. The feedback was not bad.
Yeah, good. I did not think that's where you're going with that. The feedback was awful. I have a lot of work to do.
Well, Robert, thank you so much for your time. We'll raise a glass to that. Cheers.
Yeah, cheers.
Clink, clink. Well, Robert, I want to thank you so much for your time and coming into studio with us today. We were particularly excited to have you in. And I just want to tell you, I really respect what y'all are doing. I love the value and commitment to history and tradition that you're bringing in with your products.
Yeah.
And so how can people find them, Teenie?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're intrigued, if you're thirsty now, you can visit Iron Root Republic Distillery. It's open every Saturday with tours at 1 p.m. And the first Saturday of each month, you can stop by between 2 and 8:30 p.m. Enjoy the cocktail lounge there. They often have food trucks, live music, all that good stuff. Make a day of it. Go up to Denison.
Heck yeah.
I shake the best I can with the cocktail shaker. So.
Yeah. Shake it till you make it.
That's right.
I'll cheers to that.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Grapes and Grain Podcast. If you'd like to be featured in our future listener mail segment, please email any questions, comments, or anecdotes to grapesandgrain@gmail.com. That's grapes, the letter N, grain@gmail.com.
Absolutely. We love to hear from listeners and share fun stories and answer any random questions we get. You can also follow us on Instagram and Facebook. Find us on Instagram at grapesandgrainpodcasts, _ between each word, and just search for Grapes and Grain Podcasts on Facebook.
Remember, that's grapes, plural, grain, singular. You can also find us online at grapesandgrainpodcast.wordpress.com to see blog posts that go more in-depth to each episode. You can also download or stream our podcast there and find lots of other content about beer and wine.
And of course, find us on patreon.com/grapesandgrain if you'd like to pledge a monthly contribution. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast today.
Cheers!
What you drinking?